History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. In the antebellum era, leading Southern politicians, diplomats, clerics, planters, farmers, and merchants preached the transformative world historical role that the newly created Confederacy would take on. They didn't just imagine the legalization of slavery forever. They imagined an empire that would extend south all the way to the South Pole. The Confederacy would become a trade empire, one of the wealthiest places in the world, and they would also take on huge infrastructure projects, building railway networks and canals and telegraph lines, and make the area surrounding Richmond and Norfolk more connected than New York and Washington, D.C. None of this, of course, happened, but that doesn't mean that the Confederates didn't dream and draw up extensive plans for what they would do after they won the Civil War. Today's guest is Adrian Brettel, and he wrote a book on this topic called Colossal Ambitions: Confederate Planning for a Post-Civil War World. We explore how leading Confederate thinkers envisioned their nation, its relationship with the United States, its place in the Americas, and its role in the global order. We also look at if the Confederacy actually had some good ideas. Most of them were horrific and called for the expansion of chattel slavery in the Caribbean and Latin America. But were there any good ideas that they had? Finally, we see how a small slice of the Confederacy did actually live on. About 10,000 Confederates left the United States after the war ended, took their slaves with them, and set up a colony in South America and tried to plant the seed of a restored Confederacy. What happened with that colony? Did anything actually take root? Or did it just die off and the settlers get absorbed by the local population? We'll look into all that and more in this episode with Adrian Brettel. I'm really looking forward to this discussion because I've looked at counterfactuals many times on this podcast, and I've also talked with guests about the myth of the lost cause of the Civil War. This is an idea that for a long time was very fashionable, particularly among Southerners, that the American Civil War was just and heroic. And it wasn't really about slavery, but it was about states' rights and tariffs and free trade. Well, let's use that as a launching point to dive right into one of the most contentious issues argued about the Civil War, the lost cause myth, and go head in first into it, like Stonewall Jackson leading a cavalry charge. So based on the post-war plans that leaders of the Confederacy themselves wrote, how accurate are the claims of those who support the lost cause myth?
Oh, Scott, that's an excellent question. And I think the important thing to grasp about the lost cause is that it's an invention during the post-war period, coming to terms with the defeat and the sudden realization that Confederates were, after all, former Confederates, will now have to remain in the Union and make the best of it. It's not an accurate representation of the purpose of war while it was being fought. You have, before and after, individuals like Edward Pollard, Jefferson Davis himself, and others sort of had dramatically different plans and ambitions for the future that they had during the war than they had afterwards. The lost cause component, as you mentioned about state rights and free trade, well, those were salient debate points that were being fought for by the South, the Southern Rights, and the Democrat Party with its policy of free trade after the war. So it made sense, if you're going to strengthen those sort of platform ideas, that you give them historical salience and that you connect it in with, well, that's what we fought for during the Civil War as well. So, you know, you had to be sort of fighting for relevant ideas, and then you reinvent, and then history is molded to support those relevant contemporary ideas, state rights and free trade. At the same time, irrelevant ideas, irrelevant notions like slavery, well, slavery's gone dead in 1865. There's no point talking about fighting for that in the Reconstruction and Gilded Age America. So what do? You shut up about it and you talk and you say, and the Civil War wasn't about slavery. Slavery is sort of airbrushed from history. And of course, we mustn't forget the main thing about the lost cause, which is about, and this is totally opposed to my to what I write about in my book, is, of course, a fundamental precept is of lost cause that the Confederates could never have won the war. They were doomed to lose those, you know, both heroic, romantic soldiers led by those Christian gentlemen, Stonewall Jackson, Robert E. Lee, against the masses, the numberless hordes of Union soldiers led by that drunken, prototypical modern figure of Ulysses S. Grant, the sort of harbinger forerunner of 20th century industrial war. And you see the lost cause, I say, is totally is a romantic doomed quest for state rights that is constructed by the needs of the late 19th century. And it is a rewriting of history to do that. What I try to do in my book is sort of clear away that if you like, the overlays of the lost cause and get back to what they were fighting for during the war, the kind of nation state and how different. And as I say, it is so different to the lost cause. And we can talk about how it is with your next questions.
Well, there are many factors about the plans they had after the war. And one of the most interesting, for me at least, are the plans for expansion, particularly to the South. The Southern thinkers who are architecting the Confederacy, they came of age after the War of 1812. This is the height of the era of manifest destiny when the United States is spreading, taking over the claims of former European colonies. So it's reasonable to think that they have this idea of expansion. Recently, much land was acquired in the Mexican-American War. Can you tell me about how far south into Mexico, the Caribbean, perhaps other directions, Confederate thinkers imagine they would expand the Confederacy?
That's an excellent question. And I mean, obviously, antebellum America, you need to look at Thomas Jefferson, who you've mentioned before, you know, that there are that Americans, even before the Mexican War, during and after, had these enthusiastic expansionist ideas, these dreams of Caribbean empires. And scholars, and I think, you know, this has been something that scholars have talked about, particularly with slaves, connecting with slavery as well, that these were occurring, you know, during the 1840s and 1850s. You mentioned about the sort of pushing aside of European colonies, there's the Monroe Doctrine, America asserting its primacy in the Western Hemisphere. But what sort of scholars have then sort of said is that during the Civil War with the Confederacy itself, they almost discard those ambitions. They have to fight for this, you know, this sort of this nation state that is actually, because it needs European recognition for its independence, they drop all this expansion. They say to quote Jefferson Davis, all we desire is to be let alone. So leave us alone. We'll just sort of create our independence and we're a threat to no one. That's the sort of historian sort of idea about what happened with the Confederacy during the Civil War. After all, they were too busy fighting the war to even think about these ideas of expansion. However, what I found to my surprise, and I have to say that from the get-go, but integral to their war effort, integral to their idea of their future, was that this nation state, the Confederacy, was going to pursue a path of expansion as befitted its great power status. And to answer your question, that this was, to quote Robert Toombs, who's briefly Secretary of State, we'll expand to the South Pole. What does he mean by that? That the Western Hemisphere, South, not North, they're not interested in Canada, that is to the United States, but that we are looking to point South, we the Confederates, so that it is looking at especially Mexico, especially the Caribbean, but also moving south into the tropical zones of what might be termed the Western Hemisphere. This is not done at sort of, they're not going to redeploy Confederate armies from the Civil War to march south. This would be done by what I term the Texas model of expansion, which is peaceful, colonies of slaveholders of enslaved people would move south, as they did in Texas in Mexico, eventually form self-governing provinces that would then join the Confederacy. The same pattern would apply to Caribbean islands. We'll talk about this a bit later. There would be independent slaveholding polities that would be allied, like Brazil and Spanish Cuba, etc. But as I say, they were very firm on looking at moving south. Their priority, perhaps of a strategic aspect to expansion as well, would be to secure northern and northwest Mexico that would give them access to the Pacific Ocean, sort of be access to the two oceans. It was very much integral to their sort of idea about how to secure an independent slaveholding republic in a world that they were realists, that they had to, in order to compete in this competitive world environment with many countries hostile or to a new slaveholding republic, indeed a new republic, that they would have to have this sort of sufficient footprint in order to secure a lasting and prosperous independence for themselves.
Well, this expansion policy raises all sorts of interesting implications, and my dates are a little bit fuzzy right now when nations in Central and South America obtained independence. But at this point, are there any states that have abolished or nations that have abolished slavery that the Confederacy had its sights on, whether in the Caribbean or in Central or South America? And would they reinstate slavery? What was the thinking there?
Definitely. I mean, so, but I'll get briefly on the sort of, which the European countries that have vacated. I mean, most of Latin America was independent from Spain and Portugal in the 1810s. The Caribbean are still, many French and British colonies are still in, and so the Spanish colonies are still present in the Caribbean. But if you like, moving to mainland, if you like, Western Hemisphere, they were independent. Now, there's one slaveholding independent state, that is Brazil. The Spanish colonies still have slavery. That's Cuba, Puerto Rico. The British had emancipated slavery in their Caribbean colonies in 1833. The French followed suit in 1848. So, if you like, we'll talk, the Confederates would support the continuance of slavery where it currently exists. They would then seek to reintroduce slavery, especially into Mexico, that had emancipated slavery along with its independence back in the 1820s. Okay, so it is emphatic, to get this absolutely clear, they were about their policies of expansion, all about expanding slavery into places where it hardly existed, like Mexico, actually, because slavery really did not exist to any great extent in Spanish Mexico, where it was legal. And then they would reintroduce it into Caribbean islands, where slavery had been emancipated, had been abolished in the earlier decades. So you get a sort of a combination of guarantee where it currently exists, reintroduce it where it has been abolished, and then, yes, expanded as well, as I say, especially into Mexico, where they really saw that as both strategically and the opportunities they would see to regenerate, which got to get our head around, that they saw slavery as a modernizing impulse that would rejuvenate, redeem the economy of Mexico, and reintroduce what they saw also not only economic prosperity, but also social peace into Mexico by reintroducing or expanding this labor system into that country.
That's interesting that slavery would be seen as a progressive institution, because by this time period, in 1861, slavery is diminishing across the globe. The transatlantic slave trade had been abolished by 1808. British Empire abolished it in 1830. Russia had recently emancipated its serfs. It continues to dwindle. I think in the 1880s, it's abolished in Brazil, and there are few holdouts. There are some very small ones well into the 20th century in the Middle East and in Africa, too. But what was the Confederacy's view of the future of slavery? Can you elaborate on that? Why did they think that abolition wasn't inevitable? and why, well, the British speak of emancipation, but really they practice it simply by another name. So they're hypocrites. So could you expound on that?
Yes, I think there's a lot to unpack there. To start with, they would, and of course they would, wouldn't they? They would take issue with your overarching view of the mid-19th century as an age of emancipation. I mean, the Russian emancipation of the serfs, they saw as an attempt by the Tsar to centralize power in his own person by removing the sort of independent power from nobility. So they had a very different view. They didn't see when the Tsar emancipated serfs, this is a sudden blur against slavery. They observers saw this as a Russia-specific power grab by the Russian Tsar. Now, you're definitely right that there had been, you know, that the British Empire, we talked about emancipating enslaved people before. But for Anne, there was also the attempts by the British to stamp out the Atlantic slave trade. There's the establishment of a squadron of the Royal Navy. But from an 1850s perspective, from a Confederate perspective, they look at their own economy, which is, in their eyes, booming. Cotton production is soaring. There's also, you could argue that the sort of, that slavery is expanding across the United States, and that more than offsets its retreats elsewhere. So they see the future as one of slavery. They see slavery as, this is a, and we'll talk maybe a little bit, there's the book, I talk about this, that the mid-19th century is a time of technological breakthroughs, rapid deployment of new communications, etc., that they are sort of, that we're on the threshold of a new era where tropical regions of the globe are being opened up to exploitation and development through advances in transport, medicine, so forth. And that in order to work these tropical zones of the world, you have to have various forms of unfree labor. That is their view. And that other countries are simply going to adopt this is where the hypocrisy charge in. Britain, France, maybe the United States itself are going to work these regions with contract labor from China or India. They called it coolie labor, was the term that they'll be. So various forms of unfree labor would be used. And against those competing would be slavery, which is simply the honest description, as Confederates saw it, for how these areas are going to be opened up, quote, exploited for food, staple crop. I mean, the opportunities are that the amount of cotton could continue to soar in production. Slavery would diversify into other forms of resource extraction, like mining. And maybe there'll be other staple crops down the line, so coffee, chocolate, etc., that you can see developing. So, and here's other thing that I think is important to recognize, that they regarded British emancipation of slaves in the Caribbean, French emancipation of slaves in their colonies, and also, of course, perhaps above all, the one successful, up to this point, successful slave rebellion in Haiti against the French. But the Confederate narrative is that they saw that the end of slavery in these islands, whether it's in Jamaica, to give an example, or Haiti, to give another one, what the result of emancipation there in Confederate eyes is that it led to a collapse of the previous economy, that it relied in both cases on exporting sugar, and that they saw that emancipation had been a disaster for the economies of these islands. Because people, in their argument, you require slavery in order to produce cane sugar. So they believe that they had an economic motive, but it made sense to reintroduce slavery in order to reactivate the old plantation economies on these islands, which had been incredibly lucrative. Now, they are wrong about this. The reason why the Caribbean islands sort of exports of sugar declined was not due to emancipation, but was due to other factors, such as the British embracing free trade, which meant that they were no longer giving preference to sugar imported from the Caribbean. So that led to the decline. But so the Confederates would look at the evidence and come to a wrong conclusion. But of course, what we're dealing with is what they believed. And they were absolutely adamant that slavery is essential for the workings of a Caribbean island economy. That if you can't have people voluntarily, and they said an emancipation is proof, once the Africans were emancipated in these islands, they didn't do any work. So that's the logic. And that now suddenly all these new opportunities across the tropical, in Africa and Asia and the rest of Latin America to open up these areas, you're going to need either slavery or faux slavery or slavery light contract laborers to work these. And in that environment, slavery becomes a competitive labor system. And of course, and the other plank of this argument is that the Confederates held that if, and we'll talk about this, you know, about them thinking about themselves as being good or evil or whatever it is, their view is that once you do business with the slave power, so Britain trades directly with the Confederacy, their anti-slavery abolitionist ideas fall away in the face of economic self-interest. That because you're dealing directly with the slave power, not with the United States, you can't afford to play morality with your view. You know, that you've got to take your self-interest is to do business. You may not like slavery, but we don't much like your contract labor system of Chinese workers, or we don't much like the way you exploit wage laborers in your new mills and factories in both Britain and the United States. So there's this sort of, there's this view that slavery is actually, in their eyes, will become more acceptable, not less acceptable, in this modernizing, as they saw it, world economy. So that's why I sort of take issue with your age of emancipation narrative, which of course, yes, in hindsight, and you know, at the time, some certainly saw, but the Confederates believe that actually, no, we're moving towards, with the demands of the new world economy and et cetera, that slavery is becoming more accepted, not less.
This is exactly the type of view I want to take from their vantage point, not from ours, because at their time and place in history, it was by no means a foregone conclusion.
Yeah.
Their focus on slavery, it's not just slavery, of course. It's bundled in the entire economic model of the South, of plantations producing cash crops. And for Confederate planters, something that gets them excited almost as much as gobbling up gigantic tracts of land in Latin America is the growth of trade and turning the Confederacy into a trade empire. What did they think this would look like? Because to simplify things significantly, the North largely followed a Hamiltonian view of the economy, focused on a modern financial system, banks, manufacturing, capitalism, whereas the South followed more of a Jeffersonian view of decentralization, of the yeoman, the educated yeoman, large plantations producing crops, everything being as localized as much as it possibly could, and having independent nodes of power, like you noted with Russia removing serfs to take away power from the aristocrats, which Southerners liked, and giving it into the hands of the Tsar. So what was the model, the economic model that Southerners imagined, and how the Confederacy would lead that?
This is a very interesting question, this whole idea about capitalism and the future. I mean, the Confederates believed themselves to be modern. I think I've said that already, but even they were even to be capitalists also, passionately so. And they saw their system as more modern, their political economy as more globalist than that of the Republican Party of Abraham Lincoln, which embraced protective tariffs, economic nationalism. It's a little bit of that Hamiltonian. You know, definitely, you know, Hamilton is seen as a sort of founding father in some respect of the Republican Party platform of 1860 that was enacted during the war in some respects. The Confederates, though, viewed economic nationalism and trade barriers as actually something that's a bit of a throwback to the past, and that the future instead is one of this free trade. this, which is something of a cult in Britain as well. You have the sort of the Manchester system, Richard Cobden, John Bright, immense influential transatlantic figures who were sort of preaching the gospel of free trade, breaking down tariffs. For the Confederates, they believed that they were perfectly positioned to thrive in this new world order of free trade, where nations formed commercial pacts with each other, as Britain and France did in 1860, the Cobden-Chevalier Agreement, that this was the new world system, not the system of tariffs and protected industries and economic nationalism. What the Confederate vision, if you like, of their, I mean, the Jeffersonian vision, I have to say, well, it's certainly not one that is extolled by Confederates. Their vision they saw as not looking back to Thomas Jefferson, but looking forward to maximize production was their mantra. That and export. Slavery. This, of course, and as ever, everything's interconnected. You can't disentangle expansion, slavery, and their economic vision, the free and their social vision. They're all interconnected. So slavery is best suited to not working in factories, but resource extraction, staple crop production. And as I say, they keep on anticipating that it'll move on to mining. Never quite comes, but they are expecting that. Their system was one based, their economic vision was one based on comparative advantage. This is associated with David Ricardo, more recent, political economist than Adam Smith, but following from his precepts about division of labor, that instead what countries will do is focus on what they can do most efficiently and discard the rest of their economy for other countries, for other nation states to then fill in the gaps. So outsource everything that you can't do yourself. And Confederates believe that they're, you know, that whatever sacrifices and compromises they have to make in wartime, that in the future, they're going to outsource all their manufacturing to other parts of the world, chiefly Britain, but also the United States, France, and other countries, and that they will then be the producer to feed those manufacturing, industrializing economies. And again, they believe that slavery's future is best safeguarded in this economic interdependence between countries focusing on one particular job, one particular task, one particular industry. And at the same time, these commercial interconnections, I mean, they almost have a sort of, as I say, messianic cult view as to God, what commerce can do. They talk about it as a civilizing mission. And above all, what does it mean? That it means peace. Because the other, they knew that war is bad for slavery, but peace is good for slavery. We can usher in an era of international collaboration in place of international competition. This will safeguard the future of the slaveholders' republic. So to answer your question, yes, there is a, you know, it is more Jefferson than Hamilton, but they would both say we've left the founding fathers behind. This is in the sort of cutting edge political economy of the Manchester School in London. There are other American political economists as well, who are also sort of, you know, if you like, sort of coming up with their own twists on this. And again, it's a sort of from their perspective. If you look back at a later time, and we talked about this with emancipation, we look back upon sort of in the 1870s and 1880s, we look back, but this is the beginning of the era of protection, of Bismarck, of, and above all, of the United States and the Republican parties, the great tariff structures. But from the perspective of the Confederates, they don't necessarily see the world pointing towards this Hamiltonian vision at all. Instead, they see a very different vision of modernity appearing.
Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors. But first, I want to give a shout out to all the great podcasts on the Parthenon Podcast Network, including This American President, which you can find if you go to parthenonpodcast.com. It's interesting that the Confederacy is portrayed as backwards in its economic model and its view on human rights, but at least for how they see themselves is a much more progressive way. And this even includes infrastructure. Although they imagine themselves being the breadbasket of the world and producing resources that others may manufacture, there were extensive plans, I was surprised by this, for railway networks, canals, telegraph lines, steamboat lines, and make the Richmond-Norfolk corridor surpass New York-Washington. So had that gone, then the Acela corridor in the U.S. would have been a few hundred miles south. Can you tell me about those infrastructure plans?
Yes, I mean, this again is something that really surprised me as well. Was, in the words of Dudley Mann, who was one of the Confederate commissioners in Europe, the Confederacy become a communications highway connecting the Atlantic and Pacific worlds. And this will be done by means of railroads, of canals, steamship lines, and telegraph cables, both domestic and international. And I think this comes in again, this sort of, you got to get your head around the fact that they're students of American history. And of course, they look at the Erie Canal, that connecting the Hudson to the Great Lakes, as of course the crucial factor behind New York's rise to become the largest city in the United States. And so New York's rise, well, again, and you can see there's a definite, that the James River Kanawha Canal, which would connect Richmond and the James River across the Appalachian Mountains to the Ohio River, would enable the Confederacy to establish a hinterland in the Midwest, Ohio, Indiana, Illinois. And I think this is very important in many respects, because it's sort of the Confederate sort of view, they have a very great interest in reorientating the Midwest towards the Confederate sort of, if you like, economy. And so, as ever, these infrastructure plans also dovetail into their own strategic and political plans as well. But it is what they are doing. They are excited by these new technological revolutions, especially the oceanic cables that they see. Again, this is, they say, look, if you only knew about, if you only understood slavery, you just read Northern propaganda. But if we have direct steamship lines, direct news communications, we can break the Northern monopoly on newspaper propaganda and give you the other points of view, that it is ignorance about the true meaning of slavery. This is what they keep on saying. And that if we harness these transportation, you know, sort of these inventions, that we can not only, we can sort of be talked about reorientating trade, and with that you get sympathy and support for slavery, you deliver greater prosperity, and you get access to markets. So again, it's a dovetail. Again, it shows you that the vision is one, however extraordinary and difficult for us to grasp, but it gives it more of that reality, if you understand that it's not just a sort of, yes, it is a bit of propaganda, but it's also something that has a sort of project with investors and stakeholders that are also sort of pushing towards it. It gives it more of a reality. It gives your counterfactual, in short, back to your original question, it gives your counterfactual a great degree of reality that it almost becomes quite tangible to them, which is why I talk about it being, it's not about visionaries, it's about planners who are sort of going through, trying to get money, trying to get resources in order to set these things up.
One question that I've asked as I've looked into hypothetical victory of the Confederacy in the Civil War is what its relationship would be with the North. And there's all sorts of different scenarios. It could have been a confederation like the German system of the time. The most negative could be a armistice or a basically a neutral zone, a North and South Korea. What did they think would happen among Confederates?
I mean, this, I always think this is one of the, doing this work, one of the things, and I think it's comparatively neglected by, I would say that by other historians, but there's no, many scholars, if you look at international relations in the Civil War, they talk about the Confederacy in Britain or the Confederacy in France. What they tend to actually overlook is that the one power with whom the Confederates were there were two more. There's one that I think is fascinating, is their relationship with Mexico. But there's one that's even more important than Mexico, and that is the United States. And I think the Confederates always, the thing that they constantly expect and they plan, and above all, they plan for, is that there's going to come a moment when the fighting's going to stop and a peace negotiation is going to take over. That they're going to hash out a compromise with the United States. There's going to be a meeting in a smoke-filled room. There's going to be an armistice on the battlefield, so a ceasefire on the battlefield. And then they're going to sit down and negotiate. And that is, and they followed Northern public opinion, expressed imperfectly, as we know, in anything from the newspapers to sort of conspiracies, etc., to what Lincoln's saying, to what people in Congress are saying. They believe from time to time, these change over the course of the war, but they believe at times that the United States is going to fragment, that there's going to be a Pacific Confederacy based on California. There's going to be a Northwest Confederacy. That means the old Northwest centered on Illinois, Indiana, and Ohio. So there's at times they think that the United States is going to fragment and that the Confederacy is actually going to be a sort of first among equals in a North America that looks rather like, and they hoped it would, looks rather like Europe with a multipolar North America. And that Mexico, Canada, shorn of its British connections, would take their places in this sort of balance of power geopolitics of North America. That's one extreme. Then there is, but then, and I think, you know, then clearly they hope that the Democrat Party is going to win the, is going to make breakthroughs in off-year elections in 1862, which to an extent it does, and that it's going to win the presidential election in 1864. And of course, one doesn't forget that actually at times, even Abraham Lincoln was rather worried about how the Republicans were going to do in August 1864, expected that he would lose the election, and therefore he had to win the Civil War before the new president was inaugurated in March 1865. Because it's incalculable to what would have happened to the American war effort had, there's another counterfactual for you, but, you know, I think one could probably argue, the Confederates believe that if the Democrats won in 1864, the US soldiers would probably down tools and no longer fight. So, but anyhow, that is really getting into the realms. They took the Democrat platform of a ceasefire and a convention of all the states. They overlooked the Democratic platform that was about reunion. And then they said, well, that could be one of the outcomes, but we could also, the ideal is peaceful separation in which states, whether they're military occupied by the United States or not, would then have votes, hold their own state conventions, and would either join the United States or join the Confederacy. That was their optimum. That was their ideal way forward. But there is sort of negotiations on and off about to what extent would the Confederates be prepared to accept reunion. And this is where all these schemes come in. Even after the Republicans win in 1864, the Confederates come up with a series of proposals that they hope would elicit a Republican response. And of course, there is eventually a there are some meetings that take place. Niagara Falls in August 1864. There are a couple of missions to Richmond, Virginia, including one by Blair in the sort of Christmas that leads to the famous Hampton Roads conference between Lincoln and Secretary of State Seward on the one hand, and Confederate commissioners led by Vice President Alexander Stevens on the other. And these are performed, these are simply sort of key points in what is an ongoing sort of, by Confederates, to try to produce what they see as workable proposals to the United States. And that involves, to begin with, commercial pacts. That's part of their own worldview. They then move towards, what do the United States want? Do they want us to commit to their foreign policy, which means kicking the Europeans out of the Western Hemisphere, especially ejecting the French from Mexico. So we'll offer that. Do they then, well, that doesn't seem enough. Do we want some kind of federal authority? And that's the ideas, whether it's John C. Calhoun's two presidents idea that you get a northern president and a southern president, or a northern vice president and a southern president, who you sort of have a parallel system. Or you have, they look at the German Confederation, where member states, and this is where, again, the North Hemisphere sort of mental map comes in, that they could be a small federal authority where each state, and that means the Confederacy of the United States, each have a veto on any sort of federal kind of legislation. Or you just revert back to the Articles of Confederation. That was another Confederate proposal. Because, of course, for the Confederates, what they want is for the federal authority to be unworkable, like the German Confederation. I mean, it was no problem with them. But whether that was a sufficient sop, they believed, to the northern public opinion, that this is, that why are they, because again, all these proposals, the idea is that the northern public opinion they see is tiring of the war. Therefore, you know, as long as we preserve our red lines, which is autonomy domestically, and for the Confederacy to be an entity within the United States, within the new Union, within the Confederate Reconstruction, if you will, as long as the states can act collectively, and as long as they have domestic autonomy, meaning slavery, they're prepared to sort of be seen to be taking northern concerns seriously, particularly if they just see that northerners are sort of motivated by anger against Britain, by the wish to conquer the southern hemisphere, in short, to behave rather like themselves, and that the Confederates will be glad to ally with the North in their aggressive expansionist plans. And they put forward that at Hampton Roads. Alexander Hamilton Stevens says to Lincoln, why don't we do a joint attack on Mexico? And he seriously expects Abraham Lincoln to respond to that. It is an extraordinary, but you know, that's a reality that they're living in, and that they've been producing these ideas, and it's almost become that Lincoln is going to sort of prick his ears up at these ideas.
Of all the things that could have happened to the Confederacy, and in this episode, we've talked about the most optimistic scenario that the Confederates themselves are coming up with. There are many others, and I've heard lots, I've read several, that the Confederacy could have evolved along the lines of, let's say, a Brazil, and abolished slavery around the time that other nations like Brazil did, and perhaps reunite with the United States, perhaps continue on its own evolutionary path. Maybe it would have held more strongly to slavery or Jim Crow laws, and then over time become an international pariah like South Africa. Or one Civil War aficionado argue that the seeds of the Confederacy's destruction were in the Articles of Secession themselves, that there was no limiting factor that couldn't prevent the Confederacy from continuing to subdivide, that each state would become a sovereign nation, maybe even each county. And you would have an incredibly messy patchwork that would look like the Habsburg Empire with its hundreds of duchies and all that. So what do you think would have happened? I mean, this is, of course, speculation, but you're an informed source. So what do you think would be the most likely?
Well, to begin with, first of all, I think the Confederates viewed that the future of slavery in the Western Hemisphere, so in Brazil and Cuba, was entirely contingent on their survival. So if they were going to be militarily subjugated by the United States, that would be the end of slavery in Brazil and Cuba. So if the Confederacy had survived, then I think they would argue you've got to rewrite your sort of mental notes about the future of slavery in Brazil and Cuba. It could easily have survived. So I think there's a very interesting point about, obviously, you know, as Lincoln says, at the time, secession means state suicide. You can't construct. And the Confederates could not avoid the fact their new state would have a constitutional right to secession. However, I think their view, and I think other scholars have talked about this, is that there was an amazing Confederate sense of nationalism that developed during the course of the Civil War. And some of the more interesting transnational studies have compared and evaluated, you know, that this is an era of nationalism, and that the Confederate nationalism certainly needs to be taken seriously by scholars, And they would argue that states are more likely to join their nation state than secede and leave, that it was a compelling proposition. So I think that is, and they would see the North Korea, the hermit kingdom, the isolated kingdom, to be that of the United States. But it was a confederacy that is cosmopolitan and open to the world. But it is the United States that is erecting tariff barriers, etc., around. So they would sort of turn, of course they would, wouldn't they, turn it on its head. I mean, slavery survival, even Lincoln believed that slavery would survive until 1900. It is vast, and certainly it is difference in size and economic power compared to Brazil, Cuba, and other places. So it's survival, you know, if you ask the question, it's, I could imagine that. I think the vast expansion of cotton production of the late 19th century in places like Egypt, that went bust with a cotton boom, India and Australia, that perhaps you can see that actually the 1850s was the boom time, and that a declining price of cotton would eventually have would have undermined slavery in the long run, and that would have unwound as the economy changed in the late 19th century. If you want to end on a sort of note that I think that my opinion, you ask for my opinion, that would probably lead to its undoing, but maybe not until the Great Depression. And, you know, got other counterfactuals that would come into mind as well, like the United States in World War One. Could it have exerted a check on the German Empire if the United States was actually divided in two? So there's some big other what-if questions to ask if the United States was indeed going to be split in two.
Hey, everyone. Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors.
One thing I wonder is, now we focused on the many negative aspects if the Confederacy would have won. I mean, slavery would have spread far and wide. That was their stated intention. They thought it could survive and perhaps even thrive in the Western Hemisphere. So it's easy to look at this entire project and analyze the Confederacy's plans as relief that they didn't come to fruition. But I wonder, from everything that you looked at and all of the plans, were there any good ideas that you thought, perhaps, you know, we could isolate this thing and extract it from the, you know, system of chattel slavery? Did you see anything like that?
I think, obviously, I'm going to give you my historian's view, that is obviously, this is a very different context, so it's difficult for us to exercise judgment on whether it's good or bad or etc. But I'm going to answer your question, because I think it's a very interesting one. But of course, they believed that their ideas were good. And a couple of examples. I've mentioned already about this idea of this sort of, you know, they were open to the world. They wanted to break down barriers between nations. They were, you know, free trade, I think many would argue, is a good thing, that it is something that is dedicated towards, they called cotton clothing the world, using slavery, but the products of slavery they viewed as dedicated towards civilization around the world. But I think another very compelling one, and this is again something that surprised me in my studying, but they believe that the Confederate project, the vision, was one that was more multiracial than that of the United States. That in their model of inequality, racial inequality, or racial hierarchy, in which there is a, I mean, I call them cosmopolitan, I sort of mean that in a sort of rather sort of almost going back into a sort of early pre-Enlightenment idea, where you have a sort of hierarchy of races, Native, and especially they believe that this would appeal to Native Americans, that they would have a place in the Confederate polity, that there are inferior and superior races, but that in turn offered, quote, inferior. We had to get our heads around that this is the context in which they're operating. These racial views, abhorrent to ourselves, but for them, this is something that, look, the alternative is the United States, free labor, okay, where free labor meaning that you compete against, you are to use Lincoln's terminology, you are the product of your labor. That is what you are. In a equality of opportunity, sort of out, not equality of outcome, but equality of opportunity. And that is a fierce competitive environment where if you fail, you go to the wall. If you succeed, you achieve great wealth. Confederates stand back and vote, what would happen to freed African Americans in that environment? What has happened and will happen to Native Americans in that environment? They, quote, are not equipped to succeed in a competitive equality of relationship with whites. They will be exterminated. They will go to the wall. They will have a worse, whereas our system is one where inferior races are guaranteed places, and that this is a more moral, more feeling, less brutal environment for these. So I think that would be one where they, and they, you know, and there's evidence that this, that, as I say, they can always, you can challenge this by going, but yes, the, but yet the slaves were always fleeing and they voted with their feet to join Union lines. Yes. And that, but there is evidence the Native Americans sort of tended, supported the Confederates more than the Union, although another challenge there is, well, that's because of intertribal rivalries that were always much more important than who was pro or anti-Confederate or not. But it is something that the Confederates believed that, as ever, that was their reality. And they really continue to see themselves as the sort of guardians of, you know, whether it's of Native Americans, protectors against the Union onslaught right to the end of the Civil War.
Well, the idea of a multiracial Confederacy might seem odd to listeners, but believe it or not, this happened. And we've talked about a hypothetical Confederacy living on, but part of the Confederacy did live on in a certain sense. After the Civil War ended, this is a really interesting story, but, and it perhaps deserves its own episode. About 10,000 Confederates left the United States and they fled for Brazil at the invitation of the government, hoping they could rebuild their plantations, bring their slaves with them, and continue their way of life onward. There's a city called Americana in Brazil where the descendants live. And interestingly enough, I recommend listeners go to Google Images and look this up. There's a festival that happens once a year where locals will display gigantic Confederate flags. They'll dress up in antebellum-era garb, do dances. And they're as multiracial as you would expect a group of Brazilians to look like. So it's very, very interesting. But a part of the Confederacy did live on. So can you tell me, did any of these plans that you've researched get implemented there? Or conversely, were there any of the Confederacy's plans that were grafted back into the United States when the South rejoined the Union and could be seen in Reconstruction? So did any of these plans see the light of day?
There is an excellent question. There were also colonies of ex-Confederates also in Mexico as well, although not with the freed African Americans would accompany them. But there is this continuation. We didn't really get the chance to talk about the sort of pro-slavery alliance or Warsaw Pact of the Confederacy and other slave-holding countries, which the Confederates viewed, I mean, the Confederates viewed themselves as a peer country with countries like Britain and France, but would always support Brazil, Maximilian's regime in Mexico, and the Spanish in Cuba. So these colonies going ahead to support Brazil, support the Emperor Maximilian in Mexico, yes, you know, exhibit continuities with the earlier Confederate stewardship, if you will, of slaveholding or pro-slavery powers in the Western Hemisphere. But, and you know, I think you could hear about, I mean, this, when Robert E. Lee issued a summons, I think in it was about 1867, maybe even 1866, pretty early on, that ex-Confederates needed to return from exile and to assist in recovery of the devastated South, most, if you like, that sort of that clarion call led to a sort of return. Because many Confederates, fearing reprisals at the end of the war, did try to seek exile. But what you get by the late 1860s into the 1870s is a sort of returning of these colonists. The diaspora comes back into Reconstruction in the United States. And what about the survival of Confederate plans in Reconstruction and beyond? I think I mentioned, I mean, the big takeaway from my book is how the greatest delusion that Confederates have is their constant feeling that the United States is going to welcome them back with a compromise, that Confederate debts would be honored by the federal government, that Confederate dollars would be honored, you know, would be treated as legal tender, as well as really expecting that emancipation is just a, all of that's just a sort of negotiation ploy. They don't really mean that. So there's a period of shock and horror when it is, when this is not going to be, that they're coming back in under the terms, as Lincoln had over and over said, reunion, emancipation, and shortly, and as Reconstruction goes, it becomes, if anything, more as the process of Reconstruction unfolds. But what you then get later on is a return, is that as Reconstruction works its way through and the states rejoin the United States, that you get former Confederates reappearing as Democratic Party politicians, you know, sort of, and coming out with rhetorically and sort of in the oppositional politics of Reconstruction and Gilded Age America, repeating some of the calls for free trade, even of expansion. Of course, shorn of slavery and its sort of, and the independent Confederacy that sort of underpinned them. And so they almost cut and paste the old speeches and use them. So I think there's something about the fact that these plans, which had dominated their thinking for so long, reflexively come back in again in the mouths of Southern politicians. But reflexively, because when they do come into power, when the Democrats win, they're not interested in these ambitious plans. Because, of course, what does that mean? That would mean an expansion of the role of federal government in, and that, of course, is an anathema for all Democrats. And so they're actually, when in office, they're very suspicious of anything that smacks of expansion. But in opposition, you hear some of the old, you do get these little bizarre echoes of these old plans coming through.
Well, you've given us a lot to think about, and there's much more we couldn't get to in this discussion. For listeners who do want to look at the extensive plans the Confederacy had after the war, the name of Adrian's book is Colossal Ambitions, Confederate Planning for a Post-Civil War World. Adrian, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That's all for today's episode. If you'd like to see show notes with sources, maps, links, anything else related to this episode, and all my other ones as well, go to ParthenonPodcast.com. That's the name of the podcast network this show is a part of, along with James Early's Key Battles of American History, Steve Guerra's Beyond the Big Screen and History of the Papacy, and other great history shows as well. If you'd like to support the show, the two easiest ways to do so are to subscribe to it on the podcast player of your choice and leave a review. The second thing is to join the membership program for History Unplugged. If you do so, you'll get completely ad-free episodes for the entire back catalog, which is about 600 episodes and growing. And all you have to do is go to patreon.com/unplugged. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.